content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And from the Reader's Digest, Dear Reader, A Fight for the Future. I spent an afternoon in Kiev, Mayor Vitalis Gashakos, a few years ago for a profile I was writing. At the time, he was still a professional boxer, a heavyweight champion to be exact, and only beginning to dabble in politics. He talked about growing up in the Soviet Union, and when I asked about his interest in Ukrainian politics, he explained, I don't want to be passive. Every citizen should help develop the future of his country. Klitschko is now fighting for the future of his country alongside his fellow citizens. The situation unfolded during the creation of this issue and weighed heavily over everything. Reader's Digest is a place to celebrate family and community, and it was difficult to watch Ukrainians have their families and communities torn apart. Many of us at Reader's Digest have found hope in the heartwarming stories of ordinary people helping out, from Polish citizens donating strollers to Ukrainian families, to Germans welcoming refugees into their homes. That's what we do at Reader's Digest, focus on the positives. In that spirit, we have rounded up a list of organizations to consider donating to at rd.com/Ukraine. Please check it out. World events like this can bring us people together or divide us. Monica Guzman specializes in helping people bridge those gaps through her work with Braver Angels, a national organization out to depolarize America. On page 76, which we'll read later, she offers tips for talking to people on the opposite side of the political spectrum, and it could help you connect or reconnect with a friend during these times. Every citizen should help develop the future of their country. Sometimes a conversation is a very good place to start. And along that line, considering the things that have been happening the last couple of months, particularly the attack, well, the attack in the school in Texas was terrible, but before that, there was an attack on a grocery store in a predominantly black area. And the person who did this, the piece of you-know-what, was white, and he was attacking black people. And why was he doing that? What is the white replacement theory, and how is it fueling racist attacks? Another mass murder targeting minorities thrust white replacement theory into the American consciousness. Here we explain this racist ideology and why it's so dangerous. The Reader's Digest version. White replacement theory holds that minorities are overtaking a country's white majority and destroying white culture. It often leads to violence, including the May 2022 mass shooting in Buffalo, New York that killed 10 people. Once a fringe theory, white replacement theory has gone mainstream over the last several years via social media, politicians, and media personalities. While its name comes from a 2011 French book, its underlying ideology has been around for centuries. There are some practical ways to counteract white replacement theory. White replacement theory is a sociopolitical conspiracy theory with a body count. Nobody can say exactly how many people have died because of it in mass shootings and other forms of violence in America, but it's not a small number. That number increased by 10 on May 14, 2022, when a young white man armed with a military-style weapon and dressed in body armor and combat helmet walked into a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Police say the accused gunman, 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, posted a 180-page screed online detailing why he chose this particular store in a mostly black neighborhood. He wanted to kill black people, to fight back against the Great Replacement, that's in quotation marks. His weapon was also emblazoned with the signature insignia 14 words, a shorthand for white supremacists whose message is the core of this racist theory. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Those are the 14 words. For experts on the American white supremacist movement, this sent a stark message. It conveys to me that what a few years ago we were politely calling the alt-right has permeated the culture and has expanded the reach of its symbols, says Adele Stan, a journalist and longtime chronicler of right-wing extremism in American politics. Whatever you want to call it, it has now permeated our culture at the cellular level, and we have to talk about it. The it Stan referring to is white replacement theory, which has made its way from the fringes of American culture into mainstream discourse over the last few years. But what is this theory? Exactly how does it relate to racial inequality and systemic racism? And just how dangerous is it? We spoke to experts to answer those questions, as well as to find out what society can do to counter this racist theology. What is white replacement theory? White replacement theory, also called the Great Replacement and White Genocide, is the idea that some other, in quotation marks, group is out to destroy white people and their way of life. Proponents believe that the minority groups are replacing the white majority in the United States, and if they don't stop the influx of immigrants and suppress the political power of minorities, white culture as we know it will cease to exist. In short, it's meant to make white people afraid that they will soon lose their privileged place at the peak of society, because black and brown people, immigrants and the U.S. born alike, will submerge them. Other defining characteristics of this belief: that is an orchestrated plot and one that the Jewish people and liberals are encouraging to gain social and political advantage. This theory has its foundation in the fact that a homogeneous population cannot exist undisturbed for long. That is, a pure race can only be maintained by rigid exclusion of any outsiders, which is ultimately impossible. Therefore, white replacement theory adherents argue the outsiders must be subjugated, exiled, or eliminated. Where does white replacement theory come from? The term The Great Replacement comes from the title of a 2011 book by French author Renaud Camus, in which he argues that the immigration is diluting French culture specifically and European culture more generally. Dark-skinned Muslim immigrants from the Middle East were the ones that Camus crosshairs at the time. The 14 words, however, were coined by American domestic terrorist David Lane in the 1980s. But while the name of this theory might be a recent creation, the idea is much older vintage, and not as fringe as you might think. This is a rebranding of a very old idea in the United States, says Cassie Miller, a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's a recent term for an old set of ideas that have motivated policy in the U.S. for a very long time. Experts point to the very beginnings of the United States, when European explorers and settlers overpowered the Native Americans. When the American nation was created, it was formed around the question of who was culturally appropriate to be accepted as American, says Lawrence Ashima, who teaches American studies at California State University, Long Beach. Starting right from the beginning, how do you justify taking Native American land? You cast them as culturally incompatible population. Exclusion of the other, in quotation marks, was even written into the U.S. Constitution. In it, enslaved people were literally described as other persons and counted as only three-fifths of a person. But there were plenty of other moments in this country's history in which white ruling class panicked in response to changes in immigration, Western expansion, and economic uncertainty. That includes the nativist movement in response to an influx of Catholic immigrants from Italy and Ireland in the 1840s, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the Immigrant Act of 1924, which was influenced by an American eugenist and author whose work was later embraced by Hitler, and the more recent anti-Muslim hate crimes after 9/11. If any of you remember the film The Gangs of New York that took place in 1860s New York City, where there were the white people, the Native Americans, versus the Irish. Why is white replacement theory so dangerous? This theory maintains that white people are under attack and must do whatever it takes to fight for their survival. In the minds of adherents, it's an actual war. The threats are growing every day. The urgency, the idea that the clock is ticking, allows them to go after anyone they see as their racial enemy, says Miller, and that, of course, can lead to violence. Jews will not replace us, was the chilling chant at the Unite the Right march in Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 12, 2017. By the next morning, violence broke out between white supremacists and counter-demonstrators, and by the afternoon, 32-year-old Heather Heyer was dead, struck by a car driven deliberately into a pile of peaceful protesters. But what happened in Charlottesville was not an aberration, and violence connected to white replacement theory has become a shockingly common occurrence in the United States. Here are some recent notable examples which are counted in America's gun violence statistics, but stand out for their motives. In 2015, Dylan Roof killed 9 black people who were attending a Bible study class in Charleston, South Carolina. In his confession, he said the act was in response to what black people are doing to white people every day, all the time. Roof became the first person in American history sentenced to death for a federal hate crime. In 2019, John Ernest pled guilty to murdering one person and attempted to murder 53 others in a synagogue in the San Diego suburb of Poway during Passover. In a disturbing manifesto, he wrote that he did so to prevent the meticulously planned genocide of the European race. Also in 2019, police say 21-year-old Patrick Crucis went into a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, armed with an assault rifle with the intent to kill Mexicans. an online diatribe believed to be written and posted by Crucius, who has still not stood trial for the crimes, cited the Great Replacement and the Hispanic invasion as the cause for your attack, which left 23 dead and 23 wounded. White replacement theory around the world. In case you were wondering, this isn't a uniquely American phenomenon. In Christchurch, New Zealand, a 2019 mosque massacre, where 51 were killed and 40 wounded, was perpetrated by a white supremacist who feared white genocide. And in Norway in 2011, Anders Behring Breivik killed 77 people in a bombing and a mass shooting. Many of the victims were children attending a summer camp sponsored by the country's center-left Labour Party. Breivik blamed the Labour Party for pandering to multiculturalism and justified his crimes as preemptive war before our major cities are completely demographically overwhelmed by Muslims. For some, violence is a means to a darker end. Self-described accelerationists seek to hasten the collapse of a democratic multicultural society that threatens a supposed white race. Leaders of the Southern California white supremacist organization, Rive Above Movement, were arrested in 2018 and charged with deliberately instigating riots in a liberal enclaves like Berkeley, California. One of those leaders, Robert Rundo, fled the United States, and as of April 2022, he has reportedly been living in Bosnia and Herzegovina in Serbia, where he's engaged in far-right nationalist groups. And in general, the violence is a feature, not a bug, says Stan. It's exciting. It makes young kids feel tough. It's used for propaganda and recruitment. Who believes in this ideology? While white supremacists typically believe in white replacement theory, not everyone who believes in this theory would describe themselves as a white supremacist. In fact, the seemingly fringe theory has gone mainstream over the past few years, with inflammatory rhetoric on talk radio and cable news shows being echoed by opportunistic politicians targeting a portion of the white population that feels disenfranchised and disempowered. This is an idea that is really malleable, says Miller. Although it's often used to target immigrants, it can be wielded to a large target many different groups of people, and many groups can be blamed for the supposed nefarious process. And the number of people who believe in the tenets of white replacement theory, even if they don't use the exact words, is disturbingly high. A recent Associated Press poll published, coincidentally 2 days before the Buffalo massacre, found that around a third of Americans believe there is deliberately plot underway to allow immigrants entry to the United States for political gain. And about 30% believe that an increased immigration is causing native-born Americans to lose their economic, political, and cultural power. The difference between Democrats and Republicans on the latter question is surprisingly narrow, 27% to 36% respectively. The poll also showed that 17% believe both in the deliberate effort to sway domestic politics through immigration and the loss of native-born influence as a result. Among those who embrace other conspiracy theories, a full 42% are in that camp. Stan sees the connection between the conspiracy theories like QAnon and white replacement theory as a natural link. In every one of these conspiratorial narratives, it's all about the pecking order in society, she says. Who are the elites? Who are controlling things? And who is or not worthy? Whatever it is that the supposed elite are doing, it's keeping worthy, in quotation marks, people down. And losing one's proper place in the societal pecking order is a huge blow. Who is popularizing the white replacement theory? Once the domain of overt racists who were generally avoided in polite society, white replacement theory is now openly discussed and embraced on social media, cable news, and more. And that's an enormous problem. So how did the field of acceptable dialogue shift dramatically so fast? Social media. Social media is often blamed for the spread of hateful ideas. And while it's true that many a racist idea or false or distorted fact finds its way onto our Facebook pages and Twitter feeds, not to mention what happens on sites like 4chan and 8chan, fault can't be placed entirely in their laps. Social media companies have terms of service with standards of behavior they define. There's no legal obligation to enforce it, but there's certainly an ethical one, says Jeff Blevins, professor of journalism at the University of Cincinnati and author of the forthcoming book Social Media, Social Justice, and the Political Economy of Online Networks. Over the past few years, Facebook and Twitter have made very public efforts to clean up their sites and kick out people who post false, bigoted, violent content. But Blevins says it's too little too late. That person they kick off the site pops up somewhere else, and that message has already been spread, retweeted, saved on a screenshot. The damage is already done. but blaming the platform is not entirely fair to them, and is overly generous to ourselves, notes Stan. There's plenty of blame to be ascribed to social media companies, he says, but the leap lays responsibility on their doorsteps lets too many people off the hook. We need to have a really deep cultural discussion about this and where we went wrong. Politicians. In 2019, former Iowa Congressman Steve King was stripped of his committee assignments for public embracing white nationalism. In one of his tweets, he wrote, "Culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." Many consider that statement to be a thinly veiled reference to white replacement theory. Just 3 years later, in 2022, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who's still around, and Paul Gosar of Arizona have faced no official consequences for speaking at a conference organized by a well-known white supremacist and sharing the stage with him as he praised Adolf Hitler and spewed white genocide dogma. Miller says that line between acceptable and unacceptable political discourse has been creeping in the wrong direction for many years. Perhaps even worse is the place where politics and social media meet. The media watchdog organization Media Matters for America recently found that Facebook has been profiting from political campaign ads using right replacement theory rhetoric, including claims that migrants are invading the border. The ads were placed by a fringe organization's mainstream political committees and PACs and candidates for office ranging from local school boards to the United States Senate. Media personalities. Over the past 10 years or so, the idea of white replacement theory has been making its way to more mainstream circles, to the point where it's frequently featured on the most watched cable news program in the country, Miller says. Indeed, Fox News host Tucker Carlson has become a lightning rod for criticism in bringing white replacement theory into the living rooms of a middle America. The New York Times recently published a report showing that more than 400 instances since 2016 of Carlson repeating and promoting the Great Replacement to his audience, which reaches nearly 3.5 million viewers a night. And sadly, Carlson is not the only on-air purveyor of this inflammatory discourse. Another issue that more mainstream outlets have dropped the proverbial ball, says Stan. There is a problem in the structure of journalism at the moment that gives these extreme viewpoints space to fester. There is certainly a tolerance for certain extreme rhetoric, Stan continues. And this tolerance has grown in the political class. There's a field of journalism that doesn't know how to cope with it. They don't understand it. They don't know the code, the extremists use. The evidence has been bubbling up, but what people who needed to be paying attention haven't been doing, by not treating the threat as real, and growing traditional news outlets allowed it to fester. What can be done to counter white replacement theory? This conspiracy theory attacks the heart of America's melting pot ethos, and it shouldn't be left unchecked. While those spreading this danger dogma have a First Amendment right to speak, the rest of us have a right to stand up to them and oppose these ideas. Here are a few ways to do that. Recognize the warning signs. In many attacks inspired by white replacement theory, perpetrators exhibited clear warning signs that were ignored, or where action wasn't taken despite alarms being raised. Classmates of the California synagogue shooter, for example, told college officials about his fixation on Hitler and white supremacist murders, but because he hadn't made any specific threats, police were barred from doing anything. The mother of Heather Heyer's murderer told reports she was not aware of her son's extremist views. His teachers, however, said he professed admiration for Hitler and racist doctrine as a high schooler. And investigators are currently trying to determine whether a mental health assessment following threats to shoot up a high school could have triggered New York's red flag law and kept guns out of the Buffalo shooter's hands. But those efforts address the symptom rather than the disease. The alarm bells keep being rung, says Patrice O'Neill, a documentary producer and the CEO of Not in Our Town. There's a price to pay for hate, and we're going to find out what that price is if we don't do something. Educate yourself and find common ground. O'Neill's production company covers impunity responses to race-based violence with thought-provoking documentaries. Its most recent production, Repairing the World, tells the story of the aftermath of the 2018 shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in American history. The film premiered on May 5th, just 9 days before the Buffalo Massacre. It details how the accused killer became radicalized by listening to talk radio and joining social media frequently by alt-right activists, spouting racist rhetoric, including white replacement theory. She says that documentaries like hers can help highlight the strength of communities coming together, despite differences, to push back against those seeking to hurt territorized minorities. They're pulling people into the core value of resisting racism, turning away from anti-Semitism, and finding common humanity, she says. Fighting this connection, knowing we have to stand up for each other, we could be next, is something that comes through very clearly. Parents are deeply concerned about how their children are being influenced by the toxic nature of discord and hate messages. Tapping into that core message of fairness and inclusion, that's something that everybody can agree on. Engage in community discussion. With every film O'Neill produces, she attends a community screening in the city where it was filmed. It's part of what she calls a restorative narrative, where the community helps heal itself through talking, listening, and understanding. There needs to be opportunity and context for gathering in a safe environment and letting a majority of people express themselves in the rejection of racism, she says, because it is a majority of us who reject racism. While this is a very specific sort of community discussion, you can find others in your town. Seek out groups where people can come together, talk about the problems facing your community or the larger world, and attempt to find action-based solutions to combat racism. Hold others accountable. Media critic Dan Frumkin says there can be no more coddling of those who traffic in white replacement theory messaging. It really shouldn't be hard for most people to agree that talking about white replacement is harmful and racist, he writes for Press Watch. It should be easy to say, I don't believe that. Those who can't or won't say so, or will make excuses, dodge, and deflect, are presumptively racist and should be treated as such, he adds. Well, Frumkin was talking specifically about those in politics and the media, and the fact that we should be careful of the media we consume. That sentiment should carry over into our daily lives as well. If someone is sprouting racist rhetoric, even if it's subtle, say something. Remember, subtle references to racism are still racism, and if we're being truly honest with ourselves, none of this is actually subtle. But the true key to countering this problem, suggests Stans, is connecting with one another and bridging the gap. That effort, she adds, needs to start one-on-one, neighbor-to-neighbor, and to the extent that our COBA area lives permit face-to-face. We really need to connect more deeply in the physical spaces where we live and with the people we live there. It's going to be a long road, but we need to take that walk, she says. I know this sounds Pollyannish, but we're not going to get anywhere until we can speak in a community of people with a variety of experiences and decide that living in this kind of fear of each other is not freedom. We need to find strength in each other. Now, on a much, much lighter note, is cucumber a fruit or a vegetable? Cucumbers have been called vegetables forever, but are they actually fruits? Fruits and vegetables mean different things to different people, but most of us classify produce based on how it tastes. Fruits are sweet and veggies are savory, and how we eat it. That doesn't stop us from wondering how certain foods are technically classified. Is cucumber a fruit? And for that matter, is tomato a fruit? Those aren't the only foods in question. If you're the sort of enjoy reading food facts trivia, you probably also wonder whether an eggplant is a fruit, and if an avocado is a fruit or a vegetable. It's a salad's worth of questionable food classifications. So let's settle your cucumber query. Read on to find the answer to, is cucumber a fruit? Science tells us that fruits are the mature, edible, reproductive structures, namely the ovaries of flowering plants. They contain seeds, which is how the species spreads. Vegetables, on the other hand, are the leaves, stems, roots, shoots, and other parts of the plants we eat. Taste really has nothing to do with it, although vegetables and fruits are classified not just by botanists, but also by chefs, who generally use veggies in savory dishes like soups and sandwiches, and fruits in sweet treats like baked goods, jams, and jellies and desserts. In one case, the definition was even determined by the courts. In 1893, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that tomato should be classified as a vegetable based on the ways in which it is used and the popular reception to this end. The courts were interested in this matter because vegetables were taxed at the time, but fruits were not. Is a cucumber a fruit or a vegetable? Well, it depends. How you classify cucumbers really comes down to whether you're coming at the question from a botanical or a culinary standpoint. So let's dive in and answer the questions at hand. Is cucumber a fruit? Why is a cucumber a fruit, botanically speaking? If you're looking for an answer that puts in the plant's biology over its use in the kitchen, here you have it. But then, botanically speaking, cucumbers are fruits. But exactly why is a cucumber a fruit? Simply put, it fits the scientific description. As you've learned, a fruit is a byproduct of the fertilization of a flower, and it contains the seeds of the plant. So botanists make a firm claim that cucumbers are fruits because they develop through fertilization of flowers and contain seeds. Though there are almost 100 varieties of cucumber, including seeded and seedless, all are considered fruits. That might be as mind-boggling as discovering that peanuts aren't actually nuts, but it's true. Another fact that'll blow your mind. Cucumbers are actually classified as berries within the fruit family because they grow from a single flower with only one ovum, as opposed to raspberry, not true berries, which form from a single flower with multiple ovaries. But cucumbers are not melons, though they could be paired with melons in certain dishes. Why is a cucumber a vegetable from a culinary standpoint? Since cucumbers taste savory and are used in savory preparations such as pickles and salads, but not of the fruit variety, they are considered a vegetable by culinarians the world over and have been for centuries. Cucumbers are often eaten with tea and sandwiches or with lunch or dinner, never as a dessert. They're also always found in vegetable aisle of the supermarket, alongside tomatoes, scallions, and green onions, lettuce, and other veggies. So from a cultural and culinary perspective, cucumbers are considered vegetables. Does it actually matter what we call cucumbers? Yes and no. It's important to know the facts about what we're eating, and cucumbers and tomatoes are fruits, no matter what you grew up believing. Is cucumber a fruit? It is from a botanist's point of view. Is cucumber a vegetable? Yes, from a culinary and cultural point of view. With facts being what they are, both fascinating and important, it is good practice to refer to what you are eating by its proper classification, or at the very least be aware of so that you can be annoying know-it-all from time to time. It's also a smart move to brush up on other cucumber facts, like the fact that they're very low in calories and have a high water content. They also contain potassium, magnesium, and vitamins K, C, and A. The bottom line, no matter what you want to call cucumbers, as long as you're eating them, you're winning. And let's look at some letters now from Reader's Digest. Where have all the nurses gone? That's terrible. I shouldn't do that. I can't sing that well. I was made to be a nurse and can't see myself in any other profession. Your article about the nursing shortage came just as the Federal Trade Commission began investigating traveling nursing rates. Capping their pay can only negative affect all nurses. Healthcare executives make millions, and nurses deserve higher wages instead of pay scrutiny. That would certainly help the shortage. Nicole Vidak in Swanton, Ohio. Pandemic silver linings. These quarantine silver linings were a welcome relief. I could see the smiles of the senior couple who found a new chance at love during the pandemic. I felt energized to get outside by the bicycling family, the road less pedaled, and felt the grandmother's joy in leading virtual grandma garden for her grandson. It gave me hope that in spite of large hardships, the human spirit will endure. Susan DiVerno, Lyndhurst, New York. I survived. How frightening it must have been for the person who was rescued from quicksand after being stuck for 12 hours. You can get out on your own by lying on your back, arms outstretched, and slowly pull each leg out of the quicksand. Once loose, gently rock toward dry terrain. Your body is less dense than quicksand and will float. Ben Zuckerman, Los Angeles, California. From the editors, the chief ranger at Zion National Park describes a simpler method to safely escape quicksand. A century of stories. I love the 100th anniversary from February. As a kid, I was the nerd who beat everyone to the vocabulary test and used a pen. Reader's Digest isn't just a magazine. It represents who we are culturally and the changes we've experienced. Thanks for being there for us. Paula Elofson-Gardine, Lakewood, Colorado. Everyday Heroes. It makes me proud that a fellow Detroiter came up with an idea to help both the homeless and the environment. How many people could figure out how to turn recycled potato chip bags into insulated sleeping bags? As Errata J. Oleta did. I applaud her brilliance. Jane Lancott, Indianapolis, Indiana. The fight to save Texas spectacular coral reefs. Clint Moore's encounter with the manta ray in the Gulf of Mexico in February reminded me of a quote from the environmental educator David Sobel. Transcendent experience in nature is worth 1,000 nature facts. Stacy Hagwood, Garner, North Carolina. Growing hope. All of Jane Goodall's response to be optimistic about the future confirmed what I already know to be true, as sung by Luke Bryan and Most People Are Good. I bemoan public discourse to insist we are all mad or mad, either definition of the word. I know we're not. John Mick II, Evanston, Illinois. Tipping the Scales, from the editors of our March-April 2022 article, How Much to Tip, generated a robust response from both sides of the table. Here is a sampling. As a server and bartender, I take exception to your tipping advice. Pre-pandemic, 15 to 20% was normal. Now it does nothing to offset our financial loss from years of closing and limited service. Suggesting that 10 to 15% is acceptable was even more outlandish. Fortunately, my customers tip well to keep us afloat. David Smith, Bel Air, Maryland. The new guidelines are good to note. I wish there was also a note for companies that give huge raises to higher-ups while expecting most of the workers to get by on less during record inflation times. Being more generous to that labor pool, too, would help everyone tip better. Beherant Desai, East Longmeadow, Massachusetts. The World of Good Reasons to Smile. The Fairy's Godmother. Should you find yourself wandering in Alexandria, Virginia, be sure to clash your gaze down. You just might spot a 2-inch door at the base of a stone wall, or a vivid real portal on a tree in front of a frozen custard shop. These fairy doors are the creation of Kate Young, 30, for the express use of fairies. Young got the idea of a few years ago after becoming enchanted by a small door in a tree with a stone path and a bridge. So she erected her own tiny structures, about 100 of them in total. One favored a tiny post office installed against a dogwood, collected around 100 letters from children asking, "Who are you? What are you?" "I'm a fairy real estate agent," she says. "I build the houses, and the fairies move in." How sweet. Everyday heroes. Dads on duty. When gang violence spiked, parents in Louisiana high school said, "Not on our match." And there's 5 gentlemen standing here. A couple of them are big, hefty guys that I wouldn't want to mess with, I'll tell you that. And the 5 of them were Reverend George McLean, David Tellesy, Torian Walters, Michael Morgan, and Craig Lee, along with other dads, helped bring peace to Southwood High. On Thursday, September 16th, 2021, just weeks into the school year, 2 groups of boys brawled across the courtyard at Southwood High School in Shreveport, Louisiana. The following day, 2 groups of girls picked up where the boys had left off. In a mere 2 days, 23 students were in police custody. One was charged with battery for alleged hitting an assistant principal. Another student was charged with threatening resource officer and a staff member. When a school administrator told her former classmate, Craig Lee, a business owner and community activist, that gang tensions were rising, Lee wanted to do something. He contacted Michael Lafitte, a fellow activist who had an 11th grade daughter at Southwood. That Sunday, the 2 held an emergency meeting with parents and the principal. By the end of the 4-hour session, the group of fathers in attendance had decided to take time to make their presence known on campus. By the way, all these guys are wearing big shirts that say, "Dad's on duty." "We're dads," says Lafitte, told CBS News. "The best people to take care of our kids are who? Us. And by the way, they are all African American." That's how Dad's on Duty was born, its goal. To make sure kids are safe, around 40 men organized into 6-person shifts with 2 shifts on campus every day. They started the day after the meeting. The dads are business owners, truck drivers, chefs, and financial advisors who sacrifice their own schedules and commitments. Some are fathers of kids at the school, while others are uncles, grandfathers, brothers, and men like Lee, who doesn't have a child at Southwood, but wants the youth in his community to know they have an entire village behind them. Now, anyone who wants to enter the school with rage and a closed fist will have to dodge boisterous papa bears, big smiles, positive affirmations, and a plethora of awful dad jokes. It's hard to be a tough guy when somebody's uncle has just tricked you into checking your shoelaces for the umpteenth time, only to find that they are not, in fact, untied. Since Dad's on Duty arrived on campus, fights have directly declined, and gang battles have stopped completely. "The school has been happy. You can feel it," said one student. Another told the Washington Post, "They interact with all the kids like they're their own children." But it's not just corny jokes and bubbly good mornings that have healed Southwood. It's a positive presence promotion, developed by Dad's on Duty to make sure everyone, every student, feels as if someone is invested in their success. That means taking an interest in home lives, engaging in a dialogue about entrepreneurship and alternatives to gang culture, sponsoring essay contests, and ultimately making sure every kid has an adult they trust to turn to in times of crisis. The dads aren't meant to replace security guards or disciplinarians. If they do see a fight, they get security or an assistant principal on the scene ASAP. Their presence is meant to be more preventive than reactionary. For instance, one day after school, Dad on Duty Mike Morgan noticed that a student he'd been bullied was milling about outside with friends. Morgan suspected they were lying in wait for the student's tormentor. Morgan found the bully and steered him clear of the area, likely avoiding an assault. It was a situation requiring more delicacy and a personal investment than law enforcement or security might have offered. The Shreveport dads have already partnered with fathers in other parts of the country who followed their example. Groups in Henderson, Nevada, Little Rock, Arkansas, and Jackson, Mississippi have formed versions of Dads on Duty, Lee says. As Lafitte told people, "The more merrier. We'd like this to be the same as the PTA, something that is in every school in every county." Reader's Digest World of Good. Hey, that's me. My Jandrovitz knows that the value of a good doll. That's Amy Jandrovitz. I hate when they put the big letters in front. You can't tell if it's an A or a part of a name. Dolls have power we don't completely understand, she told the Today Show. It's a conclusion she came to while working as a pediatric oncology social worker, using dolls to help her young clients adapt to their changing medical situations. Many of the kids saw themselves in those dolls, but for kids missing a limb or had lost their hair, there were none they could relate to. So 7 years ago, when a friend revealed that her child was transgender, Jandrovitz, now 49, knew what might help the youth through his potentially challenging period. It's hard to tell a kid, you are perfect the way you are, and to build self-esteem that way, but never offer them anything that looks like them, she says. Jandrovitz went about changing that. She crafted a doll by hand, using fabric, stitching, and markers, that resembled her friend's child and set it off. After the friend posted a photo online of the happy child and doll, another woman asked Jandrovitz to make a doll that looked like her baby who was missing a leg. Word spread, and soon Jandrovitz was making dolls for children with scars, birthmarks, facial deformities, trichotomies, in short, a doll that looked like them. She quit her job and started a nonprofit, A Doll Like Me. Working out of her home in Milwaukee, from photos sent by parents or caregivers, it takes Jandrovitz roughly 7 hours to craft each doll. A GoFundMe page helps her offset costs and allows her to donate her services. She hasn't charged for a doll since she began her nonprofit. In all, she's made in 400 dolls. The waiting list is long, and Jandrovitz is unbowed. As she explains on her GoFundMe page, every kid, regardless of gender, ethnicity, age, medical issue, or body type, should look into the sweet vest of a doll and see their own. Everyday miracles, a perfect match. And there's a picture of a young lady in front of her computer getting kissed by a dog coming out of the computer, and a cup that says, adopt, don't shop. As an only child, Nicole Renee often felt lonely in her youth. But all that changed when she turned 10. For her birthday, Renee's grandmother surprised her with an adorable gray puppy named Chloe. From the very start, the two were inseparable. She was my best friend, Renee says. Every ounce of love gave, the little dog returned tenfold. He was such a sweet dog, Renee said. She'd lick your face forever if you didn't stop her. But when Renee was 14, her father got a new job that came with a devastating caveat. He'd be working from home, and the house needed to be free of audible distractions. Chloe was very happy, Renee says. I was just a kid, so I didn't have any choice in the matter. I didn't want to get rid of my dog. I just felt so sick and sad about it. With no easier option, the family surrendered Chloe to the Humane Society. Though they were optimistic that the dog would find a new home, with people who loved her, they couldn't know for sure. I called the Humane Society to try to find out what happened to her, Renee says, but they couldn't be telling anything, so I never knew. In time, Renee grew up and got married and had a child of her own. But her dad and family didn't feel quite complete. Remembering the joy that having a dog had brought her as a kid, Renee wanted her daughter to experience the same. She had it in mind that she would adopt a puppy. But then one day she saw a post on Facebook about a senior dog that needed a new home. The dog in the photograph looked a lot like Chloe. She was even named Chloe. In an instant it was decided. She would adopt this older dog. When she met Chloe, Renee was struck with an uncanny feeling. The dog seemed so familiar. And Chloe appeared to say the same way about Renee. She ran up to me and started licking my face, she says. Chloe reminded Renee so much of her old dog that the emotion overwhelmed her. I was crying, Renee says. I just knew in my heart that it was her. Still 8 years had passed since Renee had last seen Chloe, so the notion seemed a little more than wishful thinking. My whole family thought I was nuts. But her mom realized there was a way to test the theory. Their Chloe had been microchipped as a puppy. They found the ID number, then Renee took her new Chloe to the vet to be scanned. Sure enough, she also had a microchip. The numbers were a match, Renee says. I felt like I'd won the lottery. After years of thinking she'd never see her dog again, Renee is overjoyed to have her back. I get so excited to come home and see her, she says. As for Chloe, she's made herself right at home, Renee says. And why shouldn't she? She knows that she'll be with me forever. Shepherd's Delight. A car crash in northern Idaho last year sent Tilly, a 2-year-old border collie mix, flying from his owner's vehicle. Tilly took off running and disappeared. But he was found days later on a nearby farm, happily herding sheep. And let's swing over to Consumer Reports on a product update. Get a great smartphone for less. These days, you can really find a model pack with features you want at a reasonable price. Terrific battery life. Some mid-price models deliver 40 hours plus per charge. This 400 plus OnePlus 8T logged 23.5 hours in our labs, enough to last a full day without being recharged. Powerful cameras. Modestly priced phones can have premium features like four cameras, wide, an ultra-wide angle, zoom, and monochrome on the back of the OnePlus. Beautiful displays. A few or lower priced models have state-of-the-art OLED screens. Many of the rest feature LCD screens that score well with CR's testers. High-tech security. The OnePlus 8T lets you unlock via fingerprint sensor. Some mid-price models use facial recognition. Dual SIM cards. With this phone's two cards, you can have two numbers ring on the same device, one for personal calls and one for work. Now that's cool. Not so long ago, you had to make a painful choice when shopping for a new smartphone. Either shell out big money for a top-of-the-line model or settle for a no-frills budget phone with limited features and battery life. In recent years, however, Apple, Samsung, and rivals like OnePlus have released an armada of mid-priced phones that can compete any levels with even the most expensive devices, which these days run upward of $1,000. More than half of the 50 phones in our current ratings are priced between $200 and $700, and many receive their Best Buy or CR recommended designation from our expert testers. The truth is, lots of features that used to distinguish top-of-the-line models, high-definition screens, image stabilization, and that artsy photo mode that blurs the background of portraits, to name a few, are now available on plenty of lower-priced models. So what are you sacrificing if you decide not to fork over $1,000 or more for your next phone? Your screen probably won't boast a refresh rate as high as those on top-tier models, so the text and images will be slightly less crisp as you scroll through your Instagram feed. You may have to do without certain advanced camera features, a high-powered optical zoom lens, for example. And you're not likely to get wireless charging, which lets you power up by setting your phone on a charging pad rather than plugging it to an outlet. For many consumers, those are easy to pass up. But here's the thing. While lower-priced models don't sport all these top-shelf features, they often do have some. If you choose carefully, in other words, you may not have to make any sacrifices when it comes to features that matter most to you. Below, we look at how today's less-pricey phones stack up in key areas, provide tips on how to find a model with the extras you covered the most. Long-lasting battery life. Even the most feature-packed phone will disappoint if it can't get you through a full day of work and play. In recent years, Apple, Samsung, and other manufacturers have stretched the battery life of their models, outfitting even budget phones with large batteries and computer chips designed to boost energy efficiency. In fact, many of today's lower-priced models delivered a once inconceivable 40-plus hours of use per charge, according to CR's testers. The 1100 iPhone 13 Pro Max logged category-best 52 hours in our labs, but the $400 Samsung Galaxy A42 5G is next at 49 hours, and the $170 OnePlus Nord N100 is third at 48.5. All told, 18 of the 50 models in our current ratings reach or exceed the 40-hour threshold. Great displays. Consumers tell CR researchers that they want phones with high-quality displays, and here again there's little need to pay top dollar to get one. Models like the 600 6.5-inch Samsung Galaxy S20 FE 5G offer the OLED screen technology found in some high-end televisions and the priciest phones from Apple and Samsung. These screens deliver sharper contrast, nearly unlimited viewing angles, so multiple people can comfortably view a photo or a YouTube clip at one time, and text and images that are easy to see in all lighting conditions, indoor or out. And the odds are good you'll be similarly impressed by traditional LCD screens on many sub-$700 phones. With a quick scan of the chart on page 21, which you'll see that 17 of the 26 models there have displays rated very good or better by our readers. Instagram-worthy cameras. There's one area where mid-priced phones tend to fall short of their premium rivals. That's photography. Not that less-pricey phones deliver obviously substandard images. On the contrary, many produce very impressive selfie shots, rear camera photos, or rear camera video, just typically not all three. And the models generally can't do as much gee-whiz photo baggage as the flagship Apple and Samsung phones. Those harness multi-camera setups, wide-angle, ultra-wide-angle, and zoom, and advanced software to capture sharp zoom images in low-light conditions, and crisp action shots from a halfway across a shocker field. But you may have to make some concessions or pay up if you're a serious shutterbug. But maybe not. It's actually not hard to find older, less expensive iPhone models with premium camera features. The $600 iPhone 12 mini and the $500 iPhone 11 have wide and ultra-wide angle rear cameras, like the iPhone 13S. And the iPhone 13 mini, which sells for $700, has an all-new camera setup designed to produce better low-light shots. You can also save by zooming in on specific advanced camera functions. For example, the $450 Google Pixel 5a 5G performs admirably well when it comes to still shots and selfies. The Ford OnePlus 8T is particularly adept at taking 1080p video, and the 280 LG Velvet 5G produces snapshots worthy of any Instagram feed. Use the ratings on the facing pages and find the photo you want. We'll look at those. Choose your bonus feature. The priciest phones on the market do bring some cool tricks to the party, including wireless charging, water resistance, and secure facial recognition tech to unlock them. If you want all of that, you probably do have to spend more than $1,000. But again, many lower price models offer one or two of those perks, so check our ratings chart or online product descriptions if there's a feature you particularly like. The $600 Samsung Galaxy S20 FE 5G, for example, has wireless charging and a memory card slot for expanding storage, in addition to a top-rated camera and long-lasting battery life. That's the sort of savvy shopping that leads to real savings, the kind worth phoning home about. Three more ways to spend less and get more. Buy refurbished. Apple restores and sells used models with new exterior shells, new batteries, and even one-year warranties. Samsung has similar standards, but not every company refurbishes with the same care. Look for a phone that's certified pre-owned. If that's not an option, make sure that it comes with a new battery and all the standard accessories, earbuds, charging cord, etc., and that any replacement parts were supplied by the manufacturer. Go retro. While Apple or Samsung release new phones, the earlier models often outfit it with high-quality cameras and displays, and other cutting-edge capabilities dip in price. The feature-packed iPhone 12 mini, for example, now sells for $600, down from $699. Snare a carrier deal. With the right timing, think dad's in grad season, back to school time, or Black Friday, you can score a big discount on a new state-of-the-art phone. To get the bargain, though, you may have to trade an eligible model in good working order, upgrade your plan, and or add a new line. Lower-priced phones with premium features. Each of these nicely priced models deliver superior performance in at least one of the areas consumers say they care about most. Battery life champ. The Samsung Galaxy A42 5G scored a 70 overall, $400. In CR's lab testing, the battery in this Samsung phone powered along for an awesome 49 hours on a single charge, second only to the 52.5 hours of the $1,000 iPhone 13 Pro Max. Camera champ was the iPhone 13 mini at $700, scored a 79. This model ranks among the top 10 of our smartphone camera ratings, with very good front and back and still image quality and rear video quality. It also has ultra-wide lens and cinematic mode found on Apple's $1,000 phones. Display champ. The Samsung Galaxy A52 5G scored a 74, $500. The 6.5-inch OLED screen on this model doesn't score quite as high as the one on the OnePlus 8T, but like the 8T and the $1,000 Galaxy, it has a high refresh rate for silky smooth scrolling, streaming, and animation. Great call. Before you shell out $1,000 for a new phone, take a look at the options below. All are priced between $200 and $700, and many of them get enthusiastic thumbs up from our experts. And these phones, and I'm going to run down the list, are the ones that got owner satisfaction, absolutely top ratings, and predictability, reliability. The Apple phone 13 mini at $700, the Apple iPhone 12 mini at $600, Samsung Galaxy S20 FE 5G at $600, OnePlus 9 at $600, Samsung Galaxy S21 FE, $700. Apple iPhone SE 2022, that's the brand new one, $430. OnePlus 8T at $400. Apple iPhone 12 at $700. Google Pixel 6 at $600. Samsung Galaxy A52 at $500. Samsung Pixel 5a 5G at $450. Samsung Galaxy A42 5G at $400. Apple iPhone 11 at $500, OnePlus Nord 500 N500 5G at $240, and Samsung Galaxy at 280. And there are others, but they scored lower in the overall satisfaction rates. Boost your brain power at any age. And we won't be able to finish this today, but we'll run through a few of the items, and then we can finish up next week. Memory-building games, superfoods, supplements, what really works to preserve and even enhance your thinking skills. Keeping our brains and memory sharp is certainly in our mind these days. In fact, 34% of Americans say they've noticed signs of forgetfulness significant enough to worry them in a March Consumer Reports National Representative Survey of 2,116 adults. It's true that the number of those diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, which Rob suffers of cognition, are predicted to keep climbing, and we've yet to find a cure. In fact, Aduhulam, the first new Alzheimer's drug to be approved in almost two decades, may offer little benefit, according to a number of experts. But evidence is piling up that lifestyle steps may reduce brain disease risk and help us maintain cognitive strength. A major 2020 report in The Lancet suggests that 12 factors within our control, including smoking, poor fitness, and obesity, are responsible for up to 40% of dementia cases. We're also seeing the potential in personalized prevention for those at higher risk of poor brain health. Take one study published in 2019, where researchers tailored risk reduction advice to volunteers' cognitive test results, weight and levels of blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar. After 18 months, most of the 174 participants, all with a family history of Alzheimer's, had improved on thinking and memory evaluations. For those who had followed recommendations closely, results were quite stunning, says study co-author Lisa Moscone, Ph.D., director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. More research is needed, but our findings make clear that it's never too late to make key lifestyle changes and see brain benefits, Moscone says. And because issues like high blood pressure are now known to have negative effects on thinking many years later, it may never be too early to focus on brain health either. Which follows are some strategies to consider. Five brief health basics. Keeping an eye on your overall health is a key for brain health, but it may be especially important to prevent certain medical issues and address them promptly when they crop up. Few other regular self-care steps may also help you reverse thinking memories. Number one, watch these health numbers. Monitor and measuring your blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar levels are all essential for optimal brain function, research suggests. We know diseases like hypertension and type 2 diabetes damage the small blood vessels in the brain, affecting parts that you need for thinking and memory, says Gary Small, MD, chair of psychiatry at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey, and author of the Memory Bible. This may be important sooner in life than you expect. While we know that uncontrolled hypertension in midlife hikes the risk of dementia in older ages, a study published in March JAMA Network Open found that higher blood pressure in young adulthood was linked to a poor brain health as early as middle age. Another study published in March found that lower HDL, good cholesterol, and higher triglycerides in people as young as 35 was associated with dementia decades later and linked high blood glucose between ages of 51 and 60 to a higher risk of future cognitive problems. Go for a hearing exam. If you often have difficulty following a group conversation, have your hearing checked. A number of studies suggest that hearing issues may affect your brain. For instance, an analysis of 36 studies published in 2018 in JAMA Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, found that age-related hearing loss was linked to an increased risk of cognitive decline. Even very minor losses may contribute. Your brain is like a computer that's reliant on an input source. If you distort the audio and video quality, it can't compute properly, says Ronald Peterson, MD, director of the Mayo Clinic, Alzheimer's Disease Research Center in Rochester, Minnesota. Sometimes the fix is as simple as having your doctor remove excess earwax, but don't do it yourself. But for permanent hearing loss, a hearing aid may be your best bet. Get good sleep. As you slumber, stay surprisingly busy, helping to solidify your memories for long-term storage. In addition, when you're asleep, your brain goes into housekeeping mode and cleans out toxins that can impair brain health, says James Leverance, MD, director of the Center for Brain Health in the Cleveland Clinic, Las Vegas. While sleep needs vary person to person, about 7 hours a night appears to be a sweet spot for the brain, according to the 2020 study published in a JAMA Network Open. Getting some of your snooze time during the day is okay, too. A regular afternoon nap of no more than 2 hours was associated with better language use and memory in older adults. In a study published last year in the Journal of General Psychiatry, but frequently sleeping more than 9 hours a night may signal that you have an underlying condition that can negatively affect brain health, like obstructive sleep apnea, says Small, So check with your doctor if you typically sleep this long. Have your meds reviewed. Your doctor or pharmacist should go over your regular meds, including over-the-counter products and supplements, at least once a year, says Sisso Borson, M.D., Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. They can see whether any may temporarily impair memory or thinking, such as prescription and OTC sleep drugs, older antihistamines, and anti-anxiety meds and narcotics. Note, certain anticholinergics, like older antidepressants and overactive bladder meds, are linked to higher dementia risk even 20 years after use. Feeling anxious? Both depression and chronic anxiety may make people more vulnerable to dementia as they age, so you may want to reach out to a therapist if you're experiencing either. If you're depressed or anxious, you're more likely to experience an increase in stress hormone levels, which are very toxic to brain cells, says Peterson. We also know that depression and anxiety have been linked to a shrinkage of the hippocampus, part of the brain involved in memory. Plus, mood issues can reduce your desire to see friends and family, and isolation itself can raise your risk of dementia. For more on social activities to help shore up your cognitive reserves, keep your brain engaged, which we will read later on. Things that are hard on your brain. Smoking. Tobacco use can hurt your brain. One review of 37 studies found that compared with never smokers, current smokers are 34% more likely to develop dementia in later life for every 20 daily cigarettes. Quitting can lower risk significantly, especially if you kick the habit by middle age. Junk food. Limit highly processed foods and those high in saturated fat like red meat and full-fat dairy. They increase inflammation everywhere in your body, including your brain, which raises your risk of dementia, says Gary Small, M.D. Too much alcohol. Heavy drinking can kill brain neurons and accelerate memory loss, says Small. Research bears this out. More than 14 weekly drinks was listed brain damage and a higher dementia risk in 2020 review published in the Journal of Neuropsychiatric Disease and Treatment. Small advises no more than 2 drinks a day for men and no more than 1 for women. How about a couple of quick quotable quotes? Lean into things that scare you. That's worth doing because that's what makes you grow. Lin-Manuel Miranda. We've always grown stronger, more widely we've opened our arms. John Meacham, a writer. I can name a lot of people who have rings. The ring is great, but what you do with that platform to impact on other people is way more important. Russell Westbrook, a basketball player. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service.